Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Carmen Kahn, Artistic Director of the Philadelphia Shakespeare Theatre. Susan Lewis makes sense of scents with a visit to a new exhibition about perfume at Longwood Gardens. We speak with sculptor Sean Kenny. A collection of animals he's created from Lego bricks is being unveiled at Philadelphia Zoo. And David Patrick Stearns listens to a new work commissioned by Relosh Ensemble by the influential modern composer Paul Lansky. That's all I had this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Carmen Kahn has an interesting problem. No, it's not financial. The Philadelphia Shakespeare Theatre, where she's artistic director, has run balanced budgets for the past 2 years. It's not artistic. The company has grown in stature and in output over the past several years, and it's currently packing them in with two concurrent productions. Now, her problem is attracting audiences of a certain age. Older people. Thanks to a vibrant educational program and long-time collaborations with local schools, her matinees sell out months in advance, and her nighttime performances are attended in the main by the under-50s. She's also attracting a very diverse audience. More than half of the company's friends on Facebook are African-American. This is an audience profile that most other arts organizations would kill for. Yet because Kahn has loved Shakespeare from an early age, she has difficulty understanding why everyone doesn't love the Bard.
I think as soon as you start reading it on your feet, you see that it's meant to be performed. And so it's very difficult for kids to analyze it in the classroom textually. So it comes alive as soon as they get up in our artists in residency programs where actors go in for a whole week with them. As soon as they get up, they understand it. It's because it's clearly to be performed, I think.
Shakespeare is to dramatic literature what classical music is to music, in that you kind of have to spend a bit of time with it to get it, and then it's very rewarding when you do. Is that reflected in your audiences, in that classical music audiences tend to be more grey-haired, shall we say? Is that the case in your non-matinee performances that you're seeing older people, or is there a good spread?
No, we are seeing mostly young people, which we would like to have some older people come, I think. Our bulk of our audience is, 24 to 49.
Wow. Yeah, the classical music audience is scratching its head, right, and being very jealous right at this minute.
Right, but also, we would like more people, mature people, to come in to see the plays.
And why is that not happening? Because surely as you, in tandem with becoming more attracted to other classical art forms, you would have thought that Shakespeare would be a no-brainer for the, over 50s.
Yeah, it's slowly happening. It's just in the past years, you see, if you come on any given night, the majority are young people. Like last night, I would say the majority were in their 30s. Last night, it was a handful of older people.
And why is that? Is it that education stopped paying attention to Shakespeare, 30, 40 years ago?
I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of it is to do with our education programs. That's been going since 2000. So we've had a decade, and those students are growing up, and they know this theater now, and it's their Shakespeare theater. So I think we've really built a young audience. And so we're actually trying to build the older audience now and really get them in too. A lot of theatres have the opposite problem, and they would say, we want the young people in because they're going to be the anchor for the future.
Yeah, but I'm sure by the young people learning to love Shakespeare earlier on, they're going to be very easily convinced to go to, shall we say, traditional theatre later on.
Yes, yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Okay, so give me a 1 minute pitch as to how I, as a 60-year-old man, or why I should come to the Philadelphia Shakespeare Theatre.
I think the clarity of the storytelling, the sort of crystal clear attention we pay, the detail attention we pay to the language and the telling of the story, my aim is that you hear every single word and thought clearly. And that's sort of our signature. Mostly people come out and say, whoa, that didn't sound like Shakespeare. That a few years ago we did As You Like It, and there was a woman at the end, and she was a little bit outraged, and she said, "You adapted that. You put modern English in that." And I said, "No. Look.
That's the greatest compliment
yes,
ever."
Yeah. She said, "I'm convinced you did. I'm going to go and look at that play and see." And I said, "I didn't." And that's how clear it is. And so that's what gets the students really excited. We have testimonials, you know, dozens of them. That was so clear. I didn't know it could be so easy to understand. And also we do exciting visual musical things as well that are all integrated. But if you want to really understand and get a clear view of the story and the language, that's what we do.
If I'm thinking about coming to the Philadelphia Shakespeare Theatre, do I need to read the literature before I come? Or is that just going to confuse me more?
You don't need to. I mean, one of our ideas is that you don't need to read a play before you come, because it's about theatrical seeing and hearing, and that's what it's about. Anyone can come with no knowledge and understand it.
And is this, I don't know, the broccoli or the spinach of theatre? Are we coming because this is something that's good for us, or are we going to walk out of here feeling entertained?
I think you're going to walk out feeling entertained. I mean, I guess I have to say that, don't I? Shakespeare deals in archetypes and the unconscious, and somehow he's able to let these images all bubble up to show us universality. There's nothing in these plays that you come away feeling like, oh, that could be me, that resonates with me. They're so universal. So I think that it's essential. It's more like the protein, I would say.
Carmen Kahn, Artistic Director of the Philadelphia Shakespeare Theatre. The company is currently presenting Macbeth and A Midsummer Night's Dream.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Of all the five senses, smell may be the least understood, but for centuries people have been trying to capture pleasant scents, many of which are found in the garden. Longwood Gardens, known for its stunning visual displays of flowers, plants and trees, is now hosting an exhibition called Making Scents: The Art and Passion of Fragrance. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers the role that perfume and other scents play in our lives.
The sweet smell of chocolate chip cookies drifting from the kitchen throughout the house. The scent of salty air wafting from the wetlands in through the open car window, the first hint of the shore on the trip from the mainland. The dank odor of wet fur from a dog that's just come in from the rain. Smells trigger memories and inform human experience. And in the garden, Longwood Gardens, Paul Redman, Jaron Loving, and Jim Sutton attest to the power of fragrance.
Hyacinths are strong for some people, but as a kid, I always loved them because one of the first bulbs to come up.
The smell of the earth. In the palm house, there's a strong, almost tropical smell.
One plant that is probably the most subtle is an iris. That would probably be my favorite flower and probably my favorite fragrance.
The exhibition at Longwood opens in the main conservatory with a large wrought iron sculpture in the shape of a perfume bottle, where Longwood's display designer, Jim Sutton, has elevated fragrant seasonal flowers, hyacinths to start.
So the idea is that when you're inside the bottle, you'll smell a flower scent.
Extracting fragrances from floral and other substances dates back to ancient times, says Richard Stammelman, professor emeritus at Williams College and author of Perfume, Joy, Obsession, Scandal, Skin.
Fragrance in those days, and especially in the Fertile Crescent, either in what is today Israel or what is today Egypt or what is today Saudi Arabia, they were used primarily for religious purposes, for festive purposes, and for medicinal purposes.
As now, throughout history, fragrance was also used for personal adornment and to make social interaction more pleasant. Head of the Horticultural Department at Longwood, Sharon Loving, points to the Roman Colosseum, which would have been filled with all sorts of smells.
They often had blankets of roses that they put above the people to sort of dampen that smell that's down in the Colosseum.
In some cultures, perfume was used to scent guests who came into a house. So then the people you invited to your house were perfumed as a sign of your hospitality.
Perfuming your guests? No longer in fashion. But there remain vestiges of other customs, says Longwood director Paul Redman.
It's like what a bride carries. It's a nosegay when she's walking down the aisle. And that really came from a much, much earlier time in tradition of women always walking around with a little bouquet of flowers to add fragrance and to cover up other odors.
In the late 1800s, the French perfume house Guerlain created a new kind of perfume called Jiqui. Richard Stamelman says for the first time, a perfume brought together many ingredients, in this case, lavender, lemon, bergamot, floral scents, synthetic ingredients like coumarin, which is the smell of freshly mown hay, vanillin, and synthetic rosewood. Holding it all together was an ingredient used as a fixative called civet, a substance from the sexual organs of
a large Ethiopian cat. The goal was to create a blend of ingredients that would be complex, that would basically produce a smell that had never been smelled before. So in other words, lavender oil smells like lavender. Rose water smells like rose. But Jiqui, unless you're a perfumer, you can't tell what it smells like.
Today, most fixatives, including civet, musk oil, and ambergris from a whale, are recreated in the laboratory, as are many of the other ingredients in all but expensive perfumes. Stamelman says Jiqui was a milestone in fragrance, the first modern perfume.
It'd be basically like playing on a piano, you know, a two-note or a three-note piece of music as opposed to a symphony.
The composition of modern perfumes is indeed described in musical terms, and like music, scent is difficult to put into words. Each perfume is a pyramid of notes, says Longwood director Paul Redman, from head notes at the top, like lavender, lemon, and violet, heart notes in the middle, such as jasmine, iris, and cinnamon, and soul notes in the base, musk, ambergris, or frankincense, to name a few.
The top notes are the lighter fragrances that you smell first, and those dissipate the most quickly. And there are the base notes of the perfume or the fragrance that are longer lasting and of a deeper fragrance as well.
As perfumes became more complex, fragrance creation turned into an art, with the perfumer called a composer, his workplace, the perfume organ.
He'd be sitting at a large desk, and in front of him, at the back part of the desk, there would be tiers, level shelves, like in an organ, except instead of the different shelves having stops, you know, it would be pulled out, as an organist would do, they were filled with bottles. And those bottles would contain different ingredients, lavender and neroli, rose, jasmine, that sort of thing. And the perfumer then would begin to combine these things.
As part of this exhibition, visitors can try combining scents with a setup modeled after the perfume organ in Longwood's music room. There are also three greenhouse ranges exploring how perfume is created from nature, the way some breeding has in certain cases diminished floral scents, and fragrance's effect on memory and human behavior. Horticultural head Sharon Loving says the scents in the garden triggered all sorts of memories in the exhibition team members.
At first, it was everyone saying, here's a fragrance. Oh, that reminds me of my mother. But then as we started walking around the garden and closing our eyes and saying, oh, what is that fresh cut, freshly mown lawn? That reminds me of summer. Or I smell the vanilla orchid. That reminds me of baking that my family did.
Fragrant plants and flowers are interspersed among 18 rooms of the 4-acre conservatory. In creating a garden, Longwood display designer Jim Sutton typically considers color, height, shape, and texture of plants. Factoring in fragrance wasn't always easy. Some fragrant flowers bloom only at night. Others are just, well, not attractive.
You'd think they'll be this beautiful thing, and they're really not. Sometimes the ones that have the most powerful scents have the most subtle flowers, and sometimes they have just a really bad form. We've looked really hard to find a frankincense tree and a myrrh tree because they're so steeped in history. But they're really unattractive little trees. They have barely any leaves on them, and they don't really do anything at all. They just sort of grow, and they extract the resin from them that they make the frankincense and the myrrh from.
Fragrant flowers are identified with special labels, and there are even plants that smell bad to us. But botanical fragrance is all about
pollinators. Yep. We think the flowers are there for us, but the flowers are there for the plant to reproduce, to get pollinated. So they do it by either by color, by attracting pollinators, or by scents.
Fragrances mean different things to different plant and animal creatures. A special fragrance was created for Longwood, where team members were asked, what does Longwood mean to you? Sharon Loving describes the responses to the perfumer, who is also called the nose.
It has to be light. It has to be universal. It has to be fresh. It has to be floral. They can pull those fragrances together in a recipe that supports what you're trying to describe. But they'll all do it differently. It's like a great chef pulling all these ingredients together.
Ultimately, talking about fragrance may be like dancing about architecture. With its ability to envelop us and tap into our memories, smell is an important window on the world. And describe it as you may, there is no substitute for inhaling deeply.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Making Sense, the Art and Passion of Fragrance, opens today at Longwood Gardens in Kennett Square and runs through November 21st. Today, Philadelphia Zoo unveils a collection of Lego brick animals designed to raise awareness of the plight of endangered or threatened species around the world. Creatures of Habitat, a gazillion-piece animal adventure, is a series of more than 30 life-sized animal sculptures crafted from hundreds of thousands of tiny Lego bricks by Sean Kenny. The Lego-certified professional created the works over the past several months in his New York City studio on a commission from the zoo. The exhibition also has an interactive component. A page at the zoo's website features information, tips, and interactive games that enable visitors to create personal sustainability plans to become part of the solution in helping preserve wildlife and save endangered habitats. I met with sculptor Sean Kenny earlier this week at Philadelphia Zoo.
We made over 30 animals that are here. The largest is the polar bear. He has 95,000 pieces in him, and it took about 1,100 hours to put together. Everything all together is nearly 250,000 pieces. So some of the smallest are little turtles and birds, and then there's all kinds of other animals and sizes in between.
You are, as you say, a Lego certified professional. How? Why?
Well, I never grew up. Honestly, I've always been playing with these toys ever since. I found photos of me when I was 2, and I never remember a moment when I wasn't playing with these toys or asking for them for my birthday or whatever. I got older. I went off to college. I took them off to me with my dorm room, and my roommates thought I was a little weird, but they were engineers and tinkerers, and so after about 3 days, they started playing with them, and they thought it was cool, too. I recall building a center console for my car. I had to put my audio cassettes in a thing, and there was no space, and so I built one out of Lego pieces because, it's like you need a plastic thing shaped like something that you can use Lego pieces. That'll do it. It was just always in my life. And so as I got older, I got a real job. I worked in an office. I sat in a cubicle for 10 years, and every day I would go home, and I would play with these toys. It was my way of unwinding after, a hard day at the office. And as I was doing that, my creations became more elaborate and more involved and more interesting and were getting more attention. And eventually, I established a relationship with the Lego company. They had been kind of watching all along, and they were really happy about the kinds of things I was doing. So now that we have a relationship, I can do more of what I do, which is good.
What are the limitations of the material? Because anybody who's played with it either as a child or as a parent playing with a child or even a grandparent playing with a child will realize quickly that it doesn't lend itself to curves, although you seem to have gotten over that with this polar bear.
Well, I think that's sort of the proof is in the pudding, right? You can really create anything with Lego pieces. It's not just square things like buildings or little cars or whatever. And sure, of course, it lends itself well to those, but I really enjoy creating organic forms. That's the most complex thing you can do with little rectangles. But as you said, you can see it. There it is. It's very, very challenging for me, and it's very, very rewarding after it's done to be able to see, the expression in the polar bear's face, for example, is exactly what I wanted it to be. It expresses the right emotion that I wanted it to emote. And that's rewarding as an artist and also something that kids can really appreciate. If you're not going to show them an oil painting, they're not going to go home and grab their watercolors. If they go look at a Rodin sculpture, they're not going to break out the Play-Doh. But for some reason, when they see this, they want to go home and they want to create and they want to play. And that is, I think, really rewarding for me because then I'm inspiring kids to be creative themselves. And that's what more can you hope for?
And what's your starting point, though? I mean, clearly Lego is your medium, but do you do models? Do you do sketches? How do you know what it's going to look like in the end?
Well, I mean, I do a lot of sketching. I sit down with a lot of photos, and I'll build little prototypes or miniatures or portions of what it is I might be making and sort of refine those as I go. It's an organic process. There's no kind of one standard way. Maybe I'll grab some graph paper and I'll draw it on the graph paper. If you wanted to make a circle, for example, you can't make a circle out of squares, but if you had a piece of graph paper and you drew it on the graph paper, well, you'd have a starting point and you could start going from there. That's kind of like what I do.
We ask this of painters and sculptors a lot. When do you know that it's finished?
It's never finished. It's finished when the time is up. It has to go in a crate and go out the door. It's never done. You have to kind of say, all right, you know what? This is as good as it'll be.
You spoke earlier about inspiring kids to go back and be creative with Lego or these toy blocks. But there is a message that the zoo commissioned this for, which is an environmental message. What is that?
Well, actually, each station has its own unique message, and the idea is that kids can go around and learn what those messages are. The polar bear, of course, is sort of the quintessential expression of an animal losing its habitat. We all sort of hear the stories, and some people argue whether or not it's happening and all those things, but it's a quintessential image of if you rode your bike to the school instead of getting a ride, or if you did something like that, then you're going to help. And other dioramas that we have set up elsewhere have different messages. For example, there is a turtle that hatches its eggs in the sands of New Jersey, but it has to cross the road to get from the ocean side to the bayside, and the babies, when they hatch, get run over by cars. And so it's a situation where just simply these motorists are inadvertently creating an endangered species. And so even kids can do something about that. Don't pick it up as a pet. You're actually making it worse, right? And so there's all kinds of things that everyone can do. And so each one of these stations tells those stories.
Sculptor Sean Kenny, creator of Lego brick sculptures that are the centerpiece of Creatures of Habitat, a gazillion-piece animal adventure, an exhibition that runs through October 31st at Philadelphia Zoo. Philadelphia's Relâche Ensemble has always had a playful side, thanks to French Dadaist influences. But now the group seems to be getting in touch with its inner Jerry Lewis, or perhaps more specifically Alfred E. Newman of Mad Magazine fame, who appears to be one of the inspirations behind the group's latest premiere, Comics Trips, by Princeton's longtime electronic music composer Paul Lansky. Yet when the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns visited Professor Lansky during faculty office hours, not a single leaping lizard, nor what me worry, was to be seen.
There's only one composer who in a single year receives royalties from rock group Radiohead. His composer-in-residence for the Alabama Symphony Orchestra and had a new piece premiered by the singular musical hybrid that is Relâche Ensemble. Paul Lansky. Explanations ought to be complicated, but aren't. The 65-year-old pioneer of electronic music wrote a piece in his late 20s whose chord progression somehow found its way into the Radiohead song Idiotech. Then when Lansky turned away from artificial sound and embraced acoustic instruments a few years ago, symphony orchestra conductors came to call. So inviting and charming is his music in any medium that Relâche came to him saying, whatever you want to do. Charm is a rare commodity in experimental music. It hardly came naturally to Lansky.
I had an epiphany about 25 years ago, maybe 30 years ago. I was writing more furrowed music, and I walked into a classroom, and there were some students playing jazz, and they were smiling. And I thought, well, hell, why can't people smile when I play my music, you know, instead of putting your hand on your forehead and closing your eyes? One thing that I enjoyed doing was in electronic music, was writing pieces that would make people smile. So, and that's sort of started with Idle Chatter.
Lansky paid serious dues for Idle Chatter. He grew up in New York City and from age 17 on worked with composer George Perle, one of the more dictatorial teachers and fiercely systematized composers of the 20th century, but one whose music also exuded easygoing wit. Lansky landed his Princeton position in 1969, working alongside uber-modernist Milton Babbitt, and spent years of pioneering electronic music composition in what now seems like almost unbelievably primitive conditions. Lansky worked with state-of-the-art computers that cost Princeton millions of dollars, but had less cyber oomph than a modern cell phone. Composing music was so painstaking, 20 minutes required 18 months. Surprisingly, much of that music holds up. Yet, nobody was more surprised than Lansky when he began writing for traditional acoustic instruments. Again, the simple explanation is that he was asked, mostly by Alabama Symphony's music director, in just the right way.
Writing an orchestral piece without the promise of a performance was much too great a risk. So for one reason or another, thanks primarily to Justin Brown, the conductor of the Alabama Symphony. They commissioned me to write this 2-piano concerto, and one of the things that he liked was he liked my electronic music. He wasn't coming after me as as an instrumental composer. He was just coming after me as a composer. And I really appreciated that.
Such was the attitude of Relâche's co-artistic director, Lloyd Shorter, who didn't know about Lansky's midlife conversion when approaching him 3 years ago to write for the group's unique, somewhat jazzy combination of wind instruments, keyboard, and percussion.
I knew that if he accepted the commission, whatever he did would be something we'd enjoy doing, whether it was something with electronics, which I thought it would be, or, as it turns out, without. Just interesting music, always a lot of heart, a lot of soul in what he writes.
Lansky loved the idea of Relâche, oddly, because it reminded him of his favorite traditional works, such as the Schubert Octet. And, like jazz groups, Relâche doesn't perform sitting down.
Relâche consisted of a bunch of people who were used to playing with each other, so it's sort of like a family, and they sort of listen to each other, and they follow each other, and they play standing up, and they really put themselves into the performance.
The comic strip motif of the new piece came about casually. Lansky doesn't plan his pieces, he just starts them by spraying notes on the page, determining what personality is emerging, and then letting the piece tell him what the rest should be like. One of the more animated movements made him think of Leaping Lizards, the famous Little Orphan Annie exclamation. It certainly beats the usual generic classical titles, like Symphony No. 1, but even Lansky's titles aren't to be taken too literally.
I don't take the title as a manifesto of any sort. I just take it as a kind of description of the spirit of the piece. You know, music that had a sort of sense of humor.
Just because Lansky has a youthful musical consciousness doesn't mean he fit right in with the pop world of Radiohead. When the group wanted to use one of Lansky's chord progressions in the song Idiotech, everything was handled above board, legally speaking, plus perks, such as New York concert tickets. It was at the live shows that the cultural difference between he and them was apparent.
And they put us in the VIP section, and we had to stand through the whole thing. And when we went in, there was this guy, they were handing out condoms. I said, what's this all about? Afterwards, so we got backstage passes, and when we were going up there, this girl looked at me and said, what are you doing here? She said, are you a fan? So I said, yes, I was a fan.
The meeting of those two worlds is revealing. By any standard, pop or classical, Radiohead creates hugely sophisticated music with surfaces so engaging that you don't need to get the sophistication in order to enter the larger musical picture. Same thing with Lansky. Ironically, the breezy What Me Worry movement of comic strips is exactly what causes Lloyd Shorter the most worry. In the middle of it, one stumbles upon the Dies Irae, the chant for the dead.
It's about music that's challenging to play, not so challenging to listen to, although it could be, depending on how deeply you wish to listen. It could be very challenging, but on the other hand, it can be something that will just kind of take you to a different place. And if we do it well, you can enter it at any level.
Though conventional wisdom would suggest that such qualities are best generated by the young and the brash, Lansky and perhaps Radiohead suggest that it's best created by the mature and the secure. Any composer who, at age 65, writes music based on comic strips can't have deep concerns about being taken seriously, or really much concern at all about how he's going to be perceived. The wit heard in Lansky's music comes out in precision and detail, elements best achieved by artists who have a lifetime of experience behind them. And it's these multiple paradoxes, these elements that resolve musical matters that are normally contradictions in the non-artistic world, that inspires listeners to come back again and again.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Relâche Ensemble performs Paul Lansky's comic strips at the Trinity Center for Urban Life in Philadelphia tomorrow evening. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester, and performed by Symphony in C under their music director, Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan. Our executive producer is Jack Moore. And I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.